Welcome to That Triathlon Show, the podcast presented by Scientific Triathlon and hosted by me, Michael Eriksson. Today I'm joined once again by Jack Hutchins for part two of our base training series. And today we'll discuss swimming during the base training phase. Just one quick note before that on a current topic, especially for those of you who are new to the podcast and have found it recently. This past weekend, we had the 7-on-3 World Championships, or actually the Precision Fuel and Hydration 7-on-3 World Championships, or Ironman 7-on-3 World Championships, if I'm being really correct. And I know that a lot of you love the interviews I've been doing with professional triathletes, and I did a deep dive into training with Jelle Hens a couple of months ago. He was super open about his training, so it was a really great chat and really interesting to listen to if you're into learning about the training that the top of the top athletes are doing. And I saw actually after the race that Jelle's coach Ben posted the video of the final sprint finish with Christian Blumenfeld, and he wrote something like 40-20 is the love-hate workout, which makes sense when you listen to that episode with Jelle and hear what that 40-20 session is about and how Jelle feels about it. So I'll put a link in the episode description so you can find it easily. Definitely, if you watch the race and you want to learn more about Jelle, the winner on the men's side, then go and listen to that. If anybody knows Lucy Charles Barclay, who of course won the women's race, then I would of course love to interview her as well. So put me in touch. That would be not nice. But for now, Jelle is the one that I can refer you to from the podcast archives. Now, just a quick thank you to our sponsors, Precision Fuel Hydration. They create carbohydrate products like gels, drink mix, and chews that are effective, practical, and tasty. And they create electrolytes in different strengths, so you can choose one that best matches your sweat sodium concentration. We're getting to the time of year, in the Northern Hemisphere at least, when indoor training is starting to play a larger and larger role for most people, and indoor training can be really sweaty. The worst is when you go to a gym to run on the treadmill, and because they usually don't have any direct fans directed at you. So if you will be sweating it up, regardless of whether it's on the bike or treadmill or anything else this winter, then bulk up on electrolytes so that you can really hydrate properly when you're sweating a lot and replace enough of the electrolytes that you will be losing in your sweat. Because not only can your performance suffer if you lose too much of your electrolyte content, but having electrolytes in your fluids also allows you to absorb the fluids more quickly, more effectively, which obviously also contributes to maintaining your performance because you will be less dehydrated and you will recover more quickly. So yeah, when you're sweating a lot, electrolytes can really help. And go and check out Precision Fuel and Hydration's options. As a TTS listener, you can get 15% off your first order by using the code TTS2025 on precisionfuelandhydration.com. Now, without any further ado, let's get into the chat with me and Jack Hutchins about swim training during the base training phase. Hey, Jack, how are you doing?
Hey, Michael, I'm good, thank you. How are you?
Yeah, I'm very good, very good. Excited for another chat. And I do think we have to start with a report about our trail race that we teased on our last episode. So, can you tell the listeners how it went?
Yeah, that was a tough one. I mean, my first trail race, you did warn me, but I wasn't expecting to be basically climbing up a mountain at one point, is what it felt like. I took a few wrong turns and yeah, but no, it was awesome. I think racing professionally in a triathlon, you basically race the race, right? You're not looking at kind of times or anything. You're just trying to go with it. And that was a similar experience that I had in that trail race. I think it's nice that maybe a lot of amateurs maybe would lose out on when they're chasing times, etc., in triathlons and on road races. It's quite liberating to just race without anything holding you back. Teaches you a lot about getting a feel for your body and just going all out, really. So yeah, it was good. But how did you find it? You had a really good run as well.
It was decent. It wasn't one of my best, but it definitely wasn't one of my worst. So I guess the results were you were second overall, I was fifth overall, but there was a pretty big chunk of time between us. I think about 10 minutes, if I recall correctly. And that was you did an hour, was it an hour 40? And I did an hour 50. I can't even remember anymore, but I think it was something like that.
Yeah, and, something like that.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, the guy who won was a couple of minutes ahead of you. So without your wrong turns, that might have been a pretty good fight. But I think it was it was a good demonstration of a bit what we talked about in the last episode with how really the general fitness that you carry into an endurance event is the most important thing rather than the specific preparation, because you obviously hadn't done any specific preparation. And I have been focusing on trail running for the last little while, but you and many other people in the start line as well, but you were, well, you were second in the race. On a, on another day, you could have been fighting for the win. So it just shows the value of just good general fitness, a good engine. And I think also from a triathlon perspective, running in triathlon is a bit different than road running, isn't it? In that it's more strength-based when you're doing it tired off the bike. And I think that's similar in trail running. It's a strength-based running rather than the more plyometric running with more elastic return that you get in, like when you're a really fast road runner running really fast speeds. What, does that sound about right to you?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's still running, right? So we're still using similar muscle groups, but there's definitely a slight change in maybe form. And yeah, we're not looking like Eliud Kipchoge and Asbel Kiprop when we're running around our 70.3s usually. So yeah, it definitely, I mean, I didn't have any specific preparation, but I had a lot of run volume, I guess, in the legs over the season. Although I was definitely a lot more sore the week after than I was when I do a half or a triathlon, just because I think probably more the descents than the climbs, that muscle damage that you have from that is pretty severe. And I think that's one maybe caution that I would give people, is if you are trying to add some trail races into a base training, then to your base training, then it's just being a bit aware that if you're not used to doing it, it's probably going to take a week of not so good training off the back of it. And when we're looking at consistency and just getting in the volume and having kind of that week in, week out, relatively good, boring routine, sometimes a trail race might not fit in. But yeah, it was a great experience and I'm definitely glad I did it.
Yeah. And how's your training coming along now? You're a couple of weeks into your base training for the 2026 season.
Exactly. Yeah. No, it's just building backing relatively gently, adding some bits of intensity in here and there, and yeah, really enjoying it. It's one of my favorite times of the year, to be honest, to be able to not have the kind of pressure of getting specific sessions in. You can be a little bit more flexible. The intensity that I do have is not superly taxing from a mental perspective, so it's, yeah, I'm just doing it for the love of it, which I think is what we should all really come back to, because yeah, on the one hand, base training should be relatively boring, right? Because that's kind of what we need, but you need to somehow find enjoyment in that boredom, I guess. And that's where I'm at right now. How about you? Did you manage to bounce back off the back of the trail race? And
yeah, I had a surprising amount of soreness, considering I've been doing these sorts of races, similar distance, similar terrain, for basically, I'm in season now rather than off season. So I've been doing, this was the, I think, the fourth race since the start of the new season in, I think it's October that the new season officially starts. So it's more of a winter season, at least with these distances, the around 20K. And in the previous races that I've been doing, so about every other week for the last couple of months, I haven't really had much soreness after, but for this one, I did have a bit more. So I actually did take a couple of days off of running, but I did some short bikes instead. So kept going in that way, and then came back to running when the body felt ready. And yeah, I came back and had some good sessions in the back end of that week. So feeling pretty good with that. And now I'm racing again this weekend by the time we're recording. So in a few days when the listeners hear this episode, and a similar distance, slightly different course, more of a just one long climb up and then one long descent down, essentially, rather than the very, very up and down course that we were served a couple of weekends ago. But yeah, things are good, and hopefully the trails don't get too wet, because we also have some big rains coming in a couple of days, I think. So there's probably going to be a lot of road running and some treadmill running as well.
More rain. I feel like I'm back in the UK at this point. For the race this
Wednesday is going to be 70 millimeters of rain.
Oh, wow.
That's like the forecast. I've never seen as big a number as that.
I'll be able to reopen the swimming pool on my balcony, which
yes.
But no, how will you approach that race where it's just basically, will you kind of look at the end of the climb, because it is just one big climb going out, as almost the finish line, and you kind of pace yourself up, and then descent is just what you have left almost?
Yeah, I find that I'm still fairly new to this, so I'm not really muscularly adapted yet to be able to just switch easily from, or in general, to do neither the climbing nor the descending comes very easily to me, I would say. So the climbing comes more easily because I can just use my engine. But muscularly, if I do a long climb and I do it very hard, I can actually just burn my legs off and then have nothing for the descent, even though I have lots of energy and shouldn't really have been over the limit. It's just a muscular limitation at the moment. So I do think I have to pace it quite well. That's what I've learned in the last little while of racing on the trails. And because you can then lose so much time on the descents if you don't have quite a lot left to give. So I would rather give up a minute or so on the climb, but then be able to bomb down the descent a bit better than I have sometimes managed in the past based on suboptimal pacing. That will be my strategy. But on race day, it's always very difficult because you have lots of people going out really fast, and I do sometimes get sucked along a bit with that. But I'll try to be sensible with the pacing on the uphill.
Yeah, I guess you don't want too much fatigue when you're kind of flying down a technical descent. I found that I wasn't even able to really push on the descent, probably because I was really cautious of falling. But yeah, so it was hard to keep the pressure on, internally speaking, on those descents.
Yeah, no, I'm the same. It's not. I don't take this seriously enough that it's worth it to have to go and get some stitches in my face, or to spend 2 weeks, 3 weeks off with a rolled ankle or a sprained ankle or something like that. But we should get into our main topics. Actually, before we do that, I have some listener questions. I forgot, of course, to put listener questions up for today's episode, but we got some for last week's episode. And I'll ask those questions now, and we can do them with rapid fire. So I'm going to ask you the first one, and then you can ask me the next one. So Jack Rinnard asks, how to best maintain triathlon-specific fitness or ability in long periods of low time availability?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I would just look at your week as a whole and how can you maximize any training within that. So if it means that you have to reduce your swim time a little bit, which is ironic given we're talking about swimming today, but if that means that you can maybe get a little bit more total aerobic volume in during that time and just do maybe go from 3 to 2 swims a week, then I would probably say that's a worthwhile compromise. And same with the bike. It's one thing I would not fall into is just adding loads more intensity because you're not able to do the volume. But you can get away with that for a short period. But when we're talking about a long period of low time availability, especially during a base period, that's not sustainable, basically.
Yeah, I have a couple of things there. A couple of athletes actually in that very situation. And from on the bike, for example, one thing that I do is that, even though I totally agree, you can do all intensity, but always doing something with purpose. So for example, one thing that I prescribe a lot is either low cadence or high cadence work within, it can be a zone 2 ride, but have intervals there with, I have progressive cadences in some sessions, working up to something that is way out of your comfort zone, but basically extending that comfort zone. And then low cadence work at mid to high zone 2 as well, I think has some value. So even with the easier sessions that you do, you can find more, I guess, more purpose and get a little bit of extra out of them, which maybe you don't want to do when you're training a lot more, because then you want to have some sessions where you just don't have to think about anything and you just run or just ride or whatever it might be. And from a run perspective, one thing that I do similar is even in an easy or zone 1, zone 2 run, add some hill sprints or strides to get a bit more quality and a bit more purpose into the sessions.
Yeah, for sure. If you can, in general, just have that efficiency focus across swim, bike, and run, that's not gonna go amiss, right? And that's not gonna be something that's unlike adding loads of kind of zone 3, zone 4 work. You're not gonna plateau or kind of struggle from that long term.
Yeah. Right. Next question.
So this one is from Runcible Adventures. That's the handle, I guess. So Michael, how to know what to focus on? Seems like too many things to work in on the off season.
Yeah, that's a big question. I think we answered some of that in the last episode, but yeah, it comes back to periodization. It's about knowing what your general limiters are, your weaknesses and your strengths, of course, and what you're working towards. What are your medium and long-term goals as well? So what are the weaknesses that are actually limiters for you in relation to those goals? I mean, that's to make the answers as short and simple as possible. I would say that that's one thing to work on. But then also things that you know will help you no matter what race or event you do. Like if you can improve your swim, for example, over a longer period of time, then even if that's not going to help you in the short term, perhaps, then that's something that basically in the off season you have more time to work on long-term projects rather than the things that can give results quickly. So you can use that to your advantage and use this time to work on things that don't give quick results, but that over the long term will help you be a better athlete. Jack Santi CVZS asks, how much is too much base?
So, I mean, yeah, we talked about this again last week in that you can't really have too much in a way where the base is to work on the physiology rather than the specificity. And if the project is long term, then we could be in that base period for, you know, years really. So it's we only want to be moving on to the specific work when you're ready, physiologically speaking. And yeah, obviously if you have races on the calendar, then that can dictate things. But sometimes it's even better to just look at those as stepping stones to a more longer term goal.
Yeah, completely agree.
So the next one is from Jabayard. So Michael, I have a lot of kg to lose. Would an extended base season, sorry, this is badly worded. So basically he's saying he wants to lose some weight. Would an extended base season work on that goal to be?
Yeah, I think it could. I think the key thing with weight loss is basically you don't want to do weight loss or focus on weight loss when you're trying to train close to your maximum capacity in terms of the overall load. So it depends on what your base season looks like, because you could also in your base training be close to your maximum load in theory, especially when you get a bit further in, and that might look in like many different ways. But basically I would say that it's not just about being in your base training phase, but it's about leaving some room. Don't be too close to your maximum training capacity when you're focusing on weight loss. So you could almost periodize your weight loss into the base training as, okay, during these 3 months, whatever it might be, I'm going to make sure that I'm training a little bit less than I would normally maybe want to do. And that's going to leave a bit more room for me to focus on weight loss and make sure that I'm not hurting myself or causing any kind of damage or limiting what I can do in training because I'm in a calorically restrictive phase. That's how I view it. What are your views on that?
Yeah, similar. I mean, towards the beginning of the base phase, I always say that it's be best to just focus on doing and putting your body in the best position in order to handle the training. So whether that be, you know, we want to be almost extra in an extra fueling state and really not looking at your body weight at all and kind of letting the body find the most optimal weight to achieve the base training goals in the first half. And then maybe towards the back end, as we're more approaching, not necessarily approaching race, but, you know, once we've established a bit of a sustainable training load, we can then look to play around with the body weight a little bit in order to achieve goals in that regard. That's how I would approach it. But I'm always looking at a kind of fuel first approach and, yeah, making sure that we're doing everything to execute the sessions to the best of our ability and hope that if we're fueling correctly and outside of sessions we're eating healthily, then the body is very good at finding that optimal weight.
Yeah, I mean, I agree, but at the same time, there are. It's fair that people ask about weight loss because many people come into the sport with objectively like weight to lose. So I think if you are in that situation, then you might not need to. Your body might not on its own find its optimal weight because you know already that you're maybe a bit above it. So in that situation. Yeah, you already kind of know that you need a period where you basically are in a slight caloric deficit. But the key is that it's slight and it's over time. Yeah. And it's not something that's done too quickly. It's not there's no quick fix. And a lot of the process-oriented things that you mentioned there are the exact things that you should do and still fuel your training and so on. Mm. But I think that maybe for some people, if you actually objectively have a bit of weight to lose, I don't necessarily think that you need to, that your body will automatically find its own weight because, you do kind of know that if you're going to lose weight, you need to be in a caloric deficit.
Yeah. I mean, it's not that your body's going to find the optimal weight for racing, but it's about, I'd be careful looking to try and lose weight when you're basically increasing training load. And that's the initial goal of the beginning phase, right? Is that we're trying to prepare the body for the training. And then after that, you can look at preparing the body for racing. So it's like, those are the two distinctions, I guess, that I'm trying to make.
I see what you mean. Especially if you're progressing your training and you don't, especially if you're progressing your training to maybe you're doing a bit more training than you've been doing before, you don't really know how far you can increase your training before you're kind of close to your current limit. And that's what I was talking about in the beginning, that I would want somebody to be well below their current limit when they do a weight loss focused period. So I guess my perspective was more that, well, you know that usually in the base training you have been doing 12 hours of training. Well, now let's do 9 hours of training and focus on weight loss instead.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's get to the swimming discussion. So that's our main topic for today. I'm going to start us off here because we mentioned some things already last week, which we both talked about swim technique. I believe we both did. So I'm going to ask you to give a bit more detail. How do you work on swim technique in the base training phase? Yeah, open-ended question. Let's go.
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, I guess we should start off by saying that we as humans, we're not instinctive swimmers, right? So it's unlike run and bike where we can just get out there and do it and the body kind of finds the most efficient way of doing those movements. It's not the same in the pool, and no amount of fitness can compensate for a bad swim stroke. So in terms of how I kind of approach the technical side of swimming is that it's about finding the priority. It's about prioritizing the most important thing within the stroke first. It doesn't matter if, for example, finger placement is wrong, if the body position is really bad, you know. So you see coaches quite a lot, they'll give very specific coaching cues on minor things when actually they should be focusing on the really big, important technical corrections that are going to have the biggest bang for the buck. So I like to make sure that for starters, we're looking at breathing, and that's not the action of getting the face out of the water. That's the inhalation and the exhalation. So in bike and run, of course, you don't have to think about when you breathe. You can breathe continuously. So that's something which is quite alien as well, is that we're making sure we're inhaling when the face is just before it comes up to breathe, and then we're getting that exhale in as it's obviously at the surface. And if we do that inhale first, that gives us, means that we can have our face above the water for less time, and that's going to help with other aspects of the stroke. So that's a kind of easy one, but I would always prioritize the breath, and then the body and head position, which are nicely linked. Again, we're looking for balance there. If we can get the head in a nice position, looking just forward and just in front of us, then we can get the head, hips, and feet at the surface. There should be a slight incline from the feet through to the head, but nothing too major. And then from there, we can look at the connection. So how are the shoulders and the hips linked together through that rotation? Have we got, as the right hand is entering the water, is that opposite left side hip driving up, and vice versa, with the right side driving down, all together in one kind of nice motion, so we can generate a lot of power there. And then after those kind of core things are sorted, we can then start looking at the arm action, the catch, the front end of the stroke, the leg action, those types of things. So that's kind of how I approach the technical side of things. Do you have any different points there?
No, I really like that. I think I'm also, breathing first, body position second. I haven't really looked at the connection as the third point, but I like that actually. I think it makes a lot of sense to put that before some of the other things with the specifics around the stroke, like the catch or those sorts of things. So that was a great summary. And I guess how do you do that? How do you know what you should work on? And then when you know that, how do you know how to work on it?
Yeah, I mean, the gold standard is having someone on poolside with you, right? So ideally, we can get someone to look at your stroke, but finding someone who has that good specific experience, not just someone who can teach someone how to swim, but how someone can teach someone to swim well within the context of triathlon, that's easier said than done, trying to find someone who has that experience. So the obvious answer for me is using filming and getting athletes to take footage of themselves, or getting someone to film them, which is hopefully for most people possible. It can be difficult with a lot of pools that don't allow it, but you can usually sneak a camera into the pool or befriend a lifeguard and get them to just sneak a little bit of footage. Most of the time they're quite understanding if you say it's for a technical purpose and you're not trying to and you're kind of careful about how you do it. But I know you use footage with your swimmers as well. What kind of how do you get them to get that footage? Because it is easier said than done, right?
Yeah, I mean, the biggest limitation is the, like you said, whether the pool will allow it. Sometimes I have given the advice to ask for forgiveness rather than permission with that. But I think just from the technical side of things, I think nowadays you have a lot of phones that can film underwater, so that's easy. I do like a GoPro, and there's a great GoPro accessory called the suction cup that you can just place on the wall. So you can on the tiles at the end of the wall, basically, where you push off, and you have the camera there. So you can see when you swim off the wall and when you come towards the wall. So you get that really good angle. And obviously, then you would need to have one of the side lanes, or maybe lane 2 or lane 7, if nobody's in lane 1 or lane 8. Then you can put it on, place it on the side, and you can also get that side view footage. It's not as optimal as moving footage. So somebody walking with the GoPro on a pole next to you, so you can actually see while you're swimming through the whole length and multiple lengths of the pool. But at least it gives you a few strokes every time you pass the camera or on your way towards the camera. So whether you use a GoPro or a phone, that's basically the main principle. if you, yeah, it's better to work with a friend that than to just do it on your own, because if you do it on your own, then you're a bit limited to angles. But if you do it with a friend, then you can get side angle, bird's eye view, and obviously from the front as well. That, yeah, those three. And from the side, I would take both above water and underneath water. So basically, those are my four key angles: side view, above the water, underneath the water, frontal view, underneath the water, and then bird's eye view. So from above, looking down from above on the swimmer, and yeah, trying to get that in. You can do it as part of a 50 or a 100, depending on how often you change angles. Do you use that, or do you have something? Do you do something different when you use footage?
Yeah, it's a really good tip about the suction cup. I mean, I always say that something's better than nothing. So even if they can just get the side angle, someone walking alongside and the front from poolside, even that's just above the water, you can still get quite a lot from those. One thing I would ask as well is, if you had any luck with putting the camera on the bottom of the pool and swimming over, because that can replace, it's not quite as good, but as the bird's eye view is quite a difficult one to get, right?
Right. Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's really good. I actually never had done that. I've seen that now, come to think of it, but I've never thought of doing that. So that's a really great point. And I would definitely recommend doing that then, especially if you're doing your own filming. So that's a good point. I mean, I will say in general with filming, we have always done that at all of our training camps, that we do individual, we get footage and then we do an individual swim video analysis with all of our training camp participants. And that's, I mean, it's usually one of the most valuable parts of the training camp for everybody. There's lots of things that people like, but just so many people have never actually seen themselves swim. And if they have, it's maybe with a phone camera just from one angle. So while I agree that something is better than nothing, if you can get like really good, like professional footage like that, not professional in the sense that it's like videography, but from a swim analysis perspective, that it can really be a game changer, I think. Mm.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, what do you, like, in terms of just the technical side of things, we talked about the prioritizing the order of priority in terms of where we should focus our efforts. How do you, like, how many points do you give to an athlete at a time, and how do you, how often are you revisiting those points with maybe footage or cues?
One or two points at a time, and usually. And how often we're revisiting it, I mean, it can be in terms of how frequently you work on those things, or sorry, how often you revisit it. I mean, to be honest, I'm mostly limited by how often my athlete will send me footage. So I would take it as, you know, on a weekly or bi-weekly basis would be ideal, but at least bi-weekly, maybe weekly might be a bit overkill, but yeah, it's rare. That rarely happens. Like, it's usually much more seldom. That it does depend a lot on the athlete's ability to get footage of themselves. Except for those circumstances when I happen to be with an athlete and be able to get footage myself, and then of course we always use that opportunity to do so. So unfortunately not as often as I would like with that. But yeah, I think it's quite important when you have analyzed your technique, you've identified your points for improvement. You can identify a lot of them and put them on a list, but I would only work on one or two at a time, basically.
Mm. Yeah, definitely. Well? No, 100%. I agree, and I think I've fallen into made this mistake in the past, is maybe trying to give too many points at once, and actually also making sure you spend enough time on that one specific cue, and not wanting to rush onto the next thing before they really nailed it, because not only is it a real order of priority and the one thing tends to make a big difference if you get it right, but also it then has different impacts on the rest of the stroke. You might find if you sort out the body position, for example, then the rotation actually is improved, or the arm action or the catch or whatever has a knock-on effect. So if you're trying to correct multiple things at a time, then one thing has a impact on the other, and it's, yeah. So I would definitely agree that less is always better.
Yeah. Also, in regards to technique, What about mobility? Is that something that you prescribe or use and that you see as a limiter for technique in a lot of cases?
Yeah, for sure. Especially triathletes coming from a bit of a swim or, a bike or run background, they can be quite tight and restricted across the shoulders and the ankles, which can actually be almost the main limitation for them progressing with their stroke. So yeah, I definitely prescribe mobility work with almost all of my athletes. And how that looks is, as part of a dedicated strength session, I'll have it in there as more of a kind of warm-up. And then also before each swim, I tend to encourage most athletes to spend 5-10 minutes just doing some either swing type work, shoulder mobility type work, or even some band work there as well. And I think it definitely has a really beneficial and is a really necessary area of focus. Do you do a similar thing? And I'd also expand on that. Do you add any specific strength work as well for the swim?
I do add strength stuff, but I don't consider it very important. But I think it's also for a lot of athletes that have regular strength training. It's not just for their triathlon performance. It's also just for longevity. It's for general health. So a lot of them want to not just have a focus on the lower body, but a bit of focus on the upper body, whether it helps their swim or not. So then I tend to, even though the focus on most strength training is on the lower body and things that will improve triathlon performance, there is a little bit of upper body work. And I tend to choose that so that there are exercises that could help with swimming performance. So that would be lat pull downs. It would be triceps extensions and rows as well. I like rows. Single arm rows, for example, is a good one. And that's basically it. Obviously, core work is, I think, is probably the most important. Strength training you can do as a swimmer, because most adult triathletes are not limited by their strength in terms of their ability to move forward in the water. But core strength can actually sometimes be a limitation, or at least the ability to use the core properly in the water. But that's where, coming back to the mobility, I think that I'm not as good as I should be at actually always getting that into the prescription. But I actually love to do a bit of a short dry land warm up with some short mobility work and core activation work. So working the shoulders, like I said, some upper and lower back and some core, including hips. That I think is, you can do that in 5 minutes. Yeah, 5 minutes is realistic, maybe less if you're really effective, but spend five minutes less swimming, and I think that usually that can pay off.
Yeah, agreed. I mean, I come from a swim coaching background initially, and I think triathletes could definitely take a bit of a leaf out of Pure Swimmer's book. And you look on any performance squad, and they tend to be on poolside 20 to 30 minutes before every session. And that's, 10 sessions a week doing a lot of general body weight, strength and core and mobility work. Yeah.
Yeah. And they're usually young. They don't have all of the stiffness that we have from the biking and running. So yeah, you can definitely safely assume that people that do a lot of biking and running, and especially as you get a bit older and you don't have as much natural mobility as you did when you were young, that at least a little bit can actually do a lot, make a big difference to how you, and that's not just to regain mobility, but also just to help you perform in that session. And if you can perform better in that session, you will have better adaptations as well.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I like to look at some of the elite swimmers, and if you just look at the way they're able to rotate and have these high elbow kind of catches, and it's not a position that 99% of people could even get into, let alone put out the force they're putting into the water.
That's the thing with strength, right? It's not about absolute strength. It's about doing a certain amount of strength, which is quite small, but doing it with the mobility that you need to have to execute a technically perfect stroke, essentially. So that's the challenge. It's not the strength itself.
So Yeah, so with that, how much load are you putting onto those strength exercises you're prescribing, the rows, etc.?
Well, yeah, it's periodized, but to be fair, I tend to work towards something that is more like low rep, high weight, but that's more so because of the, like I said, a lot of the focus is also just the general health, and that's a pretty safe bet for actually building strength that will be helpful for longevity. So that's not necessarily what I think is best for swimming. I mean, I think that probably helps. I definitely think that I mean, sprinters would do that sort of thing. So it might not be as helpful for distance swimmers and for triathletes, but I still think that it can have some small positive impact there. And then I think you mentioned band work. I think that's another thing and that's maybe something that I would want to do before the swim rather than in gym. That would probably have a more direct impact onto the swimming, because then you can combine that mobility work with strength, even though it's not high resistance strength. It's low resistance, but that could be useful. But yeah, so the strength training there is a bit of a compromise between multiple factors, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think it's you could definitely get a decent amount of load in there. We just don't need to be doing the super explosive stuff, I guess, that the sprinters would be doing.
Yeah, yeah. Let's talk about sessions. What types of sessions to do during base training? So maybe you can start us off. How do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, the core sessions I would always have in there is firstly just a general aerobic, you know, zone 1 to 2 type session with some technical stuff in there. That would be priority number one. Then actually I would add in, as one of the next probably list in priority in a base is a sets of builds or little bits of speed work sprinkled in. So think of it as kind of strides in running, but for swimming. And that's just going through the gears, obviously having a little bit more. Swimming faster is going to have a neuromuscular benefit, and it's going to really lay a good foundation for when we add in some more intensity later on. I think I'm a bit more careful with super anaerobic athletes to be in a bit more controlled on the speed of that or of how much we do. And so, but I still like to include some almost max sprints in there as well. And then another core session, the other main core session, would be a classic threshold session. With that, I like to descend to threshold or build through to threshold. I think that in the pool, it's easy to overdo it from an intensity perspective. The upper body tends to produce more lactate, and when these muscle groups are less trained, the muscle fibers are more anaerobic. So I often find it better to build towards threshold rather than starting off at the gate at that as the kind of aim, because when we do it, you quite often see that the athlete is above where we want them to be. So yeah, what about you?
Very similar. I think the first type of session that I make a priority when we start training again after the season break would be those sorts of speed-based sessions for the neuromuscular development and just mechanical development. So, I mean, that's not the only one, but that's one of the first things that I would add as a priority in addition to just technique work and base aerobic swimming. And I do also include threshold work quite frequently. I would say that more so in swimming than in cycling and running, depending on what the athlete's goal is. The threshold work might wait until a bit later in cycling and running, but in swimming, it's kind of something that I would have almost year round. I guess that's a bit of my hot take, that in terms of the sessions and the fitness itself, swimming wise, I don't periodize swimming as much as cycling and running, because I think it's maybe like it doesn't cause as much stress on the body, but it does cause more stress on the mind almost, when you have to be so focused and you have to focus on your technique and improve your technique. But I think it's so basically because it's less about metabolic fitness and cardiovascular fitness than cycling and running, I think that the periodization of the sessions that are more focused on what are we targeting metabolically and cardiovascularly, that's less important. It's more about periodizing technique. So I do keep thresholding kind of year round. But then the other thing that we also talked about in last week's episode is that I do like to have usually a couple of more, usually shorter blocks focused on where we do more VO2 max based training. So that's something that I also try to work in throughout the base training phase, but that's not how we start the base training phase. So we might definitely go a few weeks, at least a few weeks into it before we would have a block like that in most cases. So yeah, that's the gist of it, I would say. So very, very similar to you, but with the addition, I guess, of those VO2 max focus blocks.
Yeah, I mean, I would say that there's, look, talking about those blocks, I would also, as well as having the kind of core aerobic, the pure speed type sessions and the threshold sessions, the blocks that I'm adding into in amongst that would also include some more lactate production and VO2 work as well. So by that, it's not, people look at, and I think triathletes especially, VO2 max is just kind of all out speed. That's the most intensive session that they would do, but that's not the reality. And in order to get that VO2 max stimulus, we're tending to have a little bit more shorter recoveries or extending the reps slightly. So whereas with a more of a lactate production session or block, I would like to have more recovery between shorter reps and it be even, yeah, kind of one-off, one-on-one-off type sessions, 50s, that kind of stuff. And I think that really in the base phase sets a nice foundation for the work to come. It doesn't matter if we're maybe tuning the body to be a bit more anaerobic at that point, because there's enough time to bring us back to where we need to be metabolically speaking for race time.
Yeah, that makes sense. What about volume during this during the base training phase? How important is that, and how should people think about that?
Yeah, I mean, we talked about how the bike / run fitness doesn't translate that well. Obviously,
I don't think we talked about it yet.
We didn't.
Maybe I missed it if you said it. Yeah, so
maybe I think maybe not that I maybe mentioned it briefly, but yeah, so yeah, the bike / run fitness doesn't translate that well, so the central adaptations obviously do, right? You have the heart and lungs and that sort of stuff is going to be well trained, and that's going to help with the swim. But peripherally, so the capillary, mitochondrial, that type of stuff is not adapted, so the fatigue can happen more quickly there. And so that's why ultimately we need more volume in the swim, and more volume is usually better. It's always caveated with making sure that we can recover from that, and it's not looking to go to the point of taking away from the bike and run. I mean, it's in the context of your schedule, but it has to be, if we want to progress in the pool with the swim, we do need to get the volume in. And yeah, I would say that it also, with it being so technical, in order to make those technical adaptations, we need that repetition of motion, right? So thinking of the volume as not purely to get those physiological adaptations, but if it's being, as it is so technical, we need to have multiple strokes, a lot of strokes. The more strokes we can do, the more we can improve our efficiency, as well as kind of, yeah, muscular adaptations. Would you agree, or would you have a different take there?
I have done things slightly differently, but I have some things that maybe I should update my thinking around. So basically how I have approached it is that, yes, when you're a decent swimmer, pretty good swimmer, yeah, a lot of volume in the base training is really, really valuable. Exactly, because swimming is not something we do normally. So to get those adaptations peripherally, you have to do a lot of it, because it's not like you actually get some fitness if you do a lot of walking. That transfers to running, at least when you're more of a beginner. But in swimming, you don't do anything like it. So anyway, yeah, volume, super important. But for me, it has been more when you're already a pretty decent swimmer, because the more of a poor technique you have, the more I've been kind of dialing down volume, I guess, to really focus on technique and improving technique before gradually increasing volume. But I think you absolutely have a great point, of course, that it's not just about, and I have been focusing on frequency in those cases. I'm trying to get to the pool often, but there is also for sure a case to be made that you need to do a lot of strokes to really consolidate the technique changes that you're working on. So maybe I'm a bit too afraid to add more volume for people that are on the poorer side of technique. But that's been my thinking, basically, that poor technique, less volume, good technique, more volume.
Yeah, no, well, you're completely correct to have those reservations, right? And I think you said about frequency there, that's obviously a great way to make sure that if we are doing more volume, it's not under so much fatigue that you're almost consolidating bad technique. And it always needs to be a balance and a compromise and finding the right volume for every athlete, and not just about how much physically can we get to the pool and how many meters can we bash out. But yeah.
If we give some numbers, because make things specific. So how would you approach somebody who has, let's say, their threshold, their critical speed, or however you measure it, is around, let's say, between 2 minutes and 1:45 per 100, and they want to improve. They want to gradually improve and make some pretty significant improvements. How much volume should that athlete maybe be expecting to need to do versus somebody who might have a threshold of 1:30 to 1:35 and they want to improve even further to get towards that kind of very front of age group and have a 1:25, 1:20 threshold?
It's a difficult question without knowing more context, and this is always the problem of answering these type of hypotheticals, right? But yes, I would say that if improving swimming is a major goal for each of these athletes, then you're probably looking, you could manage up to 10K for the slower swimmer and then maybe 12 to 14 for the faster swimmer. And this is talking about someone who's still got a relatively balanced program.
I might have just answered a little bit less for the slower for the slower swimmer and a little bit more for the higher volume, but I mean not too much different, but maybe a little bit more polarized. But as you say, it depends a lot on the specific circumstances. We've already been talking for quite a while, so let's see, I would really like to ask your opinion on swim toys. So let's make that a topic we cover. Is there any topic in our list that you want to make sure that we still cover before we stop discussing swimming?
I think it's good to touch on the open water prep in the pool.
Let's start
that's
there.
A quick, wanna, that's do, a quick one as well.
Yeah, do you want to kick that off with the open water prep?
Yeah, so obviously in the base phase, for most people, it's not realistic to get to the ocean, to the lakes, right? It's too cold. So there's a few things we can do in the pool to make sure that transition back to swimming outdoors is easy. And one is just adding some sighting into the pool sessions. And that can be just in a warm-up or, you know, any parts of the session really, where you just sighting the end of the pool a couple times a length, every 6 to 10 strokes, etc. And just really focusing on those good sighting points, keeping the head low and integrating it into the stroke cycle. The other thing is I also like to add some dead turns or dead starts. So starting some reps, especially some of these speed type build reps that we've talked about, you can start them without pushing off the wall. And that's not only does it kind of mimic what often we have to do in a race where we're starting in deep water, but you've got to generate a lot of power from starting completely stationary without a push off. So there's some good adaptations and gains to be had there. And then the same with turns. This is quite nice. If you've got a group and you're swimming together and you've taken over a lane, I think I've talked about this in a podcast before, actually, but rather than tumble turning traditionally, you can basically all just, the first person I quite like to get to stop to just a meter or so back from the wall, and then the rest of the lane can go around them without pushing off the wall. And then you've got to get used to those sort of turn dynamics, accelerating in and out of the buoy, as it were, there. Yeah, do you use any of those things, or do you have anything to add?
Yeah, I do use sighting. I do use I do like the deep water starts, and I have also maybe not prescribed so much, but definitely used similar things, the turns, all of that. I like all of that. I think maybe for me, I don't do so much of that in the base training phase. I tend to add more of it in the specific phase, but I do think that, like I said, with swimming, you can do that stuff year round, and especially if you, for a lot of people, the racing, you know, you're never getting into the open water because you're starting racing maybe in April, but the water where you live is still very cold, so you do have to start it in the pool anyway. So whether it's in the base training phase or when you get closer to the race, all of that are things that I use. It's just a question of when. We did have, when the triathlon club that I was a part of for a good 7 years until I moved about a year ago, we had a club swims, and this was a really, really good club. Lots of athletes racing in, you know, European Cups and some World Cups even for some of the guys. So some really good athletes, a lot of them really young and up and coming athletes. The coach was really great with some of these open water specific group swims that we did. We would take out all of the lane ropes and basically put in these beach noodles and tie a weight down. So we would basically form a triangle course, and he would set off people, let's say six people at a time, in like two side by side. So two go off, two go off, two go off. And then you would basically race around that triangle course in a, well, we do have lots of lanes because we had access to the whole pool, or maybe the whole pool minus one or two lanes. So this is not really for individual athletes listening. That's obviously not achievable, but there's lots of coaches listening. Like, I thought that those sessions were absolutely brilliant. Like, they were so useful. Again, maybe more of a specific thing when you're getting closer to races. But yeah, you can do a lot of really good training in the pool for the open water. And I certainly have. And most of that was thanks to this club and the coach Andre at the club, who, yeah, he has some really, really brilliant session for that. But yeah, all of those things that you mentioned, I also do incorporate. And there's lots of things that you can do even without having access to a whole pool for yourself. Like you said, with just one lane and a couple of mates, you can do quite a lot. Another thing we did was also just swimming three people abreast in one lane. And then you don't circulate in the lane, but you just turn, and then you go back the same way, often doing that as well with fins to get the speed up and make it like a really fast and furious. So yeah, the sky is the limit. The sky is the limit, really, when it comes to how many things you can do with that open water prep. And actually, it tends to be really fun training as well, or at least I found it very fun. So it's, yeah, definitely something that I think can be included.
Yeah, and it's not, as you said, it's not necessarily needed to be far away from racing, but just makes it more interesting. Base phase is, you know, a lot of aerobic volume, so nice to mix it up.
Yeah, I mean, and about, yeah, switching topics a bit to swim toys. So, I mean, for me, I use fins and snorkel a lot, or I prescribe fins and snorkel a lot during the base phase, simply because I find those two to be the best tools for when we're really focused on technique development. So that's in a lot of drills, I prescribe them with fins and snorkel. Depending on the athlete, a lot of times they will progress to doing them with just snorkel and then eventually without anything. But for a lot of athletes that are not that fast, I always recommend basically with fins and snorkel because it helps them execute the drills better. And even just in normal swimming, most of the swims that I prescribe now, I start with 200 or 300 meters with just fins and snorkel, because I feel like that helps set up your body position while still maintaining a good kick and rhythm, and also with set a good head position with the snorkel, see what your hands and arms are doing in the first phase of the stroke underwater. So those are basically my favorite tools. I do use paddles and pull buoy quite a bit as well, of course, but those I tend to use more and more as we get closer to racing, and the fins and snorkel maybe less and less. Fins I also think are brilliant for some of the speed work that we talked about that we both like to do. So those are staples for me when it comes to swim toys in the base training phase. And how about you? What do you tend to use?
Yeah, no, I agree. I think fins are great for the technique of the kick mechanics as well. I am cautious of using fins too much because, yes, it helps with the body position, but it's almost like artificially changing the body position. So we're not racing with fins, right? If you're used to swimming, to holding a good body position with fins, sometimes it's hard to translate that. I also am conscious of making triathletes into super heavy kickers and too reliant on the kick because that is inefficient. And yeah, but the snorkel as well, they both have their place and they're both really good. It's just being conscious of why and when you're using each of those tools and making sure that they're translating to swimming without as well. I also like finger paddles, especially. Paddles in general can be, I find, too disruptive. They're especially for a lot of swimmers, especially when they have these massive paddles, they're maybe putting too much force through the shoulder and it's the elbows dropping at the front end on the catch. So a finger paddle still allows for a nice feel for the water. It's just enough resistance to get that extra force and strength adaptation, but it doesn't disrupt too much from the stroke. I also like using an ankle band, again, with a pull buoy. So this really forces good like core engagement and that connection that I talked about earlier. You really have to drive through the hip without having the kick at all there. But yeah, other than that, I probably don't use much else.
Yeah. I mean, I think those are the basics. Then there are all sorts of exotic toys, but I don't think, I mean, you have, Finnies have however many different things, gizmos and gadgets that you could use. But I think it's really like the main things that people tend to use would be in any order of importance: paddles, pull buoy, snorkel, fins, and ankle band, or at least that's how I see it. Those are the five that I tend to use. I think one addition to the ankle band that fulfills a similar purpose, I do use the ankle band as well, but just as a drill, swimming with the pull buoy between your feet, I think is quite a good drill, and I tend to prescribe that quite a bit during this time of year.
Agreed.
All right, let's maybe finish the discussion on swimming there. And do you have your headline or your topic for our surprise or Jack's surprise segment that I don't know what it is?
Yeah, so we both watched the 70.3 World Champs this weekend, right? And yeah, good race. Ironman coverage, not so good, but that's another conversation. So with the 90K bike,
I love watching hotels and yachts.
Yeah, they messed up there, and I think the T100 really making them look like amateurs in that regard. But awesome race. But no, so the bike course, 1700 meters of elevation, and yeah, I wanted to ask for your thoughts and discuss how much kind of body weight and just weight in general is a factor in a course like this and then in triathlon in general when it comes to, and what kind of things would you consider?
Yeah, well, it depends on the level. We saw over the weekend that some of the biggest, strongest cyclists were some of the biggest, strongest cyclists. So business as usual, and it didn't really change the dynamic for athletes like Magnus Ditlev or Rico Bogan. And in the women's, you don't necessarily have any of those. Like, I guess Solveig would be the one who is a bit of a bigger, stronger cyclist. But I think it's hard to read anything into her race because I think that by her own admission, she wasn't really in a place after Kona where like training for this race was a main focus, or it was as focused as it should have been if it was a really key race. So I think I'm leaning more into the men's race here just because there is more of a diversity in the athletes' sizes there. If you look at the difference between Jelle Gens and Enrico Borgen or Magnus Tittlen. But I guess the difference there is that you could see somebody like Jelle, he might not have done as well if he was a bit of a draggy course, not necessarily completely flat, because if it's completely flat, it's also hard to break away. But if it's more of a rolling course, something like Challenge Roth, I think that that's like the dream course for the big power cyclists like Magnus and Enrico. And there, some of the smaller cyclists with good power to weight, like Jelle, might struggle. But on this course, with the level of these athletes, we could see that the speeds are still pretty high. So absolute watts still matter. And yeah, you might, as a bigger athlete, you have different strengths over that course. You might use the rolling parts of that course more rather than the climbs to make your difference, obviously. But yeah, it showed that at that level, you can perform. It's not just about power to weight. Like people that just look at power to weight and think that that's going to be the determinant factor over a course with low elevation. That's just not the case. Even though it does play a role up the climb specifically, you need to have enough. But it's not about who has the most, if that makes sense. If we talk about age group level, though, the slower the speeds, the longer you're out there, the more time you spend on the climbs, it starts to matter more than, because you also are maybe not able to then use your raw absolute power as much on the rolling segments, or those segments are, relatively speaking, less important than the climb, because the climb starts to take up disproportionately more time. So I think it starts to matter more. The slower you are, really, like the longer you will be out on the course, the more it matters. So that's in a nutshell what I think about it. Does that answer the question?
Yeah, no, I think it's quite nuanced with the pros, right? Because if you look at the kind of the models of pure watts per CDA, watts per kilos versus, you know, on the different weights and this course, then they kind of, it comes out more similar. But I mean, the dynamics of the pro race, you have the lighter guys really attacking off the up steeper climbs, and then the bigger guys are basically going with those attacks or trying to limit their losses, and then the lighter guys are able to sit on the maybe flatter or downhill sections. So it's not as simple as the models maybe let on. And yes, they were able to ride with them, but then maybe that had more of an impact coming onto the run, that they've had to go so far above threshold on the climbs compared to the lighter guys. And yeah, but no, I agree that when it comes to age group or amateur athletes, it's, again, it becomes even more important. I mean, do you have any discussions with your athletes around like race course selection and playing to their strengths and weaknesses when we're considering hilly courses for lighter or heavier guys?
Yes, in many cases, yes, it depends. I mean, sometimes the athlete just wants to do a race. It could be geographically well located, or it works with their family holiday schedule. So in some cases, that's not so much a discussion point, but in other cases, if it is, okay, I want to qualify for Single Tree Worlds or for the Ironman World Championships this year, and what course should I choose to maximize my performances? Then yeah, we will for sure have that discussion, and that will be something that plays a big part. Absolutely, I was going to come back to one point with the pros, that the weight would start to have a bigger impact on a course like this if it was hot, because then, with the higher absolute power that the bigger guys need to produce, then you also produce more heat. And if it's hotter, then your risk of overheating, or at least getting close to your limit, so you have to kind of back off a bit, is bigger. So it was not at all hot over the weekend. So that was not really a factor, but on a different day, that could be a bigger factor.
Yeah, no, that's a really good point. And yeah, I mean, when do you think that some of these guys, they were able to ride with them, but they maybe did overdo it and they would have been better off backing off and letting the lighter guys get away a little bit on the climbs and maybe coming back to them?
Yeah, I mean, I'll be honest, I listened to the entire bike course. I was out running and I had my headphones in and I was listening to it. I wasn't really watching it. So I have, in that sense, I have not the full picture perhaps, but they did talk about how some of the guys were kind of dropping on and off throughout or through some parts of the race course. So yeah, I think it's a fine line sometimes. It depends on who you are and what your strengths are. I think, for example, somebody like Jelle can't let Christian go up the road, I don't think, and Christian can't let Jelle go up the road, but they can let Magnus and Rico go up the road. So if they would have had, let's say, a monster day and they would have had 20 extra watts at some point, maybe the final climb, then I could see a situation where they both could afford to let them go and it would be more sensible for them to save themselves. So yeah, that's also why the models don't tell the whole story, as you said, because the models are just for one individual athlete at a time. But in the real race, we had a group of athletes, we have race dynamics and they interact. It's a complex system basically when you have multiple athletes racing together and they know each other's strengths and weaknesses and they use that to inform their own strategies continuously throughout the bike course.
Yeah, no, all good points. I don't really have too much to add.
I guess one interesting thing as well for age groupers is, let me ask you this. Do you, when you discuss things like the bike setup, hydration and nutrition strategy, would you do things such as, on a course like this, advise taking less bottles because you know that there will be a big climb pretty soon after T1 and then maybe instead relying more on hydration off the race course to save some weight? Or how would you think about that?
Yeah, definitely. And then I had some athletes racing at Marbella and we had that discussion. So yeah, I mean, I'd always prioritize getting the fuel in that they need, and if it's a case that they have to have their specific stuff, then it's definitely not worth compromising on that. But if it's a case of, well, I can just pick this up here, we know that's there, that's after that climb, then let's reduce what we're carrying on the bike. I mean, we're talking about really minimal kind of gains here, right? But sometimes just, I think, even if it's from a psychological perspective, to know I'm one bottle down and that's going to make me feel a bit more confident and a bit better up that climb, because that all goes into it as well, right?
Yeah, exactly. I had a discussion with one of my athletes, and well, in his case, so he's a bigger guy, strong cyclist, but yeah, close to 80 kilograms. So I think another factor is one extra bottle as a percentage of your body weight when you're 80 versus if you're a 50 kg female, that's different, right? If in the former case, it's close to 1% of your body weight, but in the latter case, it's close to, or it's 2% of your body weight. So that's a big difference. And so I would be more inclined to do that. Yeah, for lighter athletes, it makes a bigger difference because you're adding a higher relative weight. But the other factor there was the start times as well. So my athlete racing there, he started in one of the later waves and he knew that he was going to be riding through some old people from the waves in front and from his own wave that were swimming faster than him. So he was a bit afraid of congestion up top at the aid station. So for that reason, we decided that no, he's going to bring all of his own bottles as usual, because it's not worth it to risk it that, you know, he might not even save him any time if he was too congested at the aid station, or it's always a bit of a risk that somebody drops something right in front of you and you have an unfortunate mechanical or something like that to spill. And so, yeah, in the end, he brought his own nutrition, but it's definitely a factor that you always have to consider. And it's, depends on a few different things.
Yeah.
Right. Well, I think that's about it for today. And I guess we'll talk about cycling next time.
Nice. No, yeah, thanks, Michael. Good chat. And I hope the listeners got some good points there.
Yeah, hope so. Speak to you soon, Jack. Take care, bye.
And you both.
I hope that you enjoyed that episode. You can find the show notes on scientifictriathlon.com/base2, and that's the number 2. If you have any questions about this episode or about our next topic, which will, of course, be cycling, then please send it to me on michael@scientifictriathlon.com. That's Michael with a K. Or DM me on Instagram @scientifictriathlonHQ. I did forget to post in the Instagram stories regarding sending a request for questions for this episode, unfortunately, so sorry about that. But yeah, if you still have questions that we didn't cover, then do send them now and we will cover them in the beginning of the next episode. And like I said, cycling related questions will also fit well into that episode because that will be our topic. Now, if you are interested in coaching and this episode made you realize that yeah, maybe now is a good time to do that and have that help throughout your base training phase, then I would strongly recommend that you check out the coaching services we offer at Scientific Triathlon. You just go to our website, scientifictriathlon.com, and you can email me to learn more and you can have a discovery call before deciding or committing to anything. We also don't have any minimum commitment times, so that's an important... Basically, we don't want to have any big barriers to entry. You can sign up. If you don't like it, you don't have to stay on for more than a month. The best time to get a coach is probably 10 years ago, but the second best time is today. And I mentioned this in the previous episode as well, but I think it's important, and so I want to repeat it. At the moment of recording, we have 90 coached athletes across 6 coaches, and the average duration that they have been with us is 24 months. But this, of course, includes athletes who have started recently. It also doesn't account for the fact that many athletes may have started 5 years ago, been with us for 3 years, then take a year break and then come back. And now they are with us for a year at this point, but they would be counted as 1 year in my spreadsheet rather than 4. So that 24 months is basically, it's a bit underestimated, and 24 months in itself is anyway well above industry standard. So I think that it's one of the best ways, one of the key indicators for the quality of a coaching service, and one of the best ways that I know to grade the quality of our work. And we're always trying to improve that, of course. So that's not to say that we're satisfied or not trying to get better, but yeah, I think it does show in a comparison for the industry that we are doing a pretty good job. And we'd love to help you and to work with you, so please reach out if you're interested. Now, finally, big thanks to our sponsors, Precision Fuel and Hydration, that you can find on precisionfuelandhydration.com. If you're looking for high-quality, practical, and tasty fueling and hydration products, make sure to try Precision Fuel and Hydration. And don't forget to take 15% off your first order with the code TTS2025. Thank you, as always, for listening. Keep training smart and keep loving triathlon.